Chapter 30. There was no reason why he should move till the stranger had passed by. The shape resolved itself into a woman's. She was looking on the ground and walking slowly, as if searching for something that had been lost, her course being precisely that of Mr. Melberry's gig. Fitzpiers, by a sort of divination, jumped to the idea that the figure was Grace's. Her near approach made the guess a certainty. Yes, she was looking for something, and she came round by the prostrate trees that would have been invisible, but for the white nakedness which enabled her to avoid them easily. Thus she approached the heap of ashes, and acting upon what was suggested by a still shining ember or two, she took a stick and stirred the heap, which thereupon burst into a flame. On looking around by the light thus obtained, she for the first time saw the illumined face of Fitzpiers, precisely in the spot whereas he had left him. Grace gave a start and a scream. The place had been associated with him in her thoughts, but as he had not expected to find him there still. Fitzpiers lost not a moment in rising and going to her side. "I frightened you dreadfully, I know," he said. "Ought to have spoken, but I did not at first expect it to be you. I have been sitting here ever since." He was actually supporting her with his arm, as though under the impression that she was quite overcome and in danger of falling. As soon as she could collect her ideas, she gently withdrew from his grasp and explained what as he had returned for. In getting up or down from the gig, or when sitting by the hut fire, as he had dropped her purse. "Now we will find it," said Fitzpiers. He threw an armful of last year's leaves onto the fire, which made the flame leap higher, and the encompassing shades to weave themselves into a denser contrast, turning even to night in a moment. By this radiance they groped about on their hands and knees, till Fitzpiers rested on his elbow and looked at Grace. "We must always meet in odd circumstances," he said, "and this is one of the oddest. I wonder if it means anything?" "Oh no, I am sure it doesn't," said Grace in haste, quickly assuming an erect posture. "Ray, don't say it any more." "I hope there was not much money in the purse," said Fitzpiers, rising to his feet more slowly and brushing the leaves from his trousers. "Scarcely any. I cared most about the purse itself, because it was given me. Indeed, money is of little more use at Hintock than on Crusoe's Island. There's hardly any way of spending it." They had given up the search when Fitzpiers discerned something by his foot. "Here it is," he said, "so that your father, mother, friend, or admirer will not have his or her feelings hurt by a sense of your negligence after all." "Oh, he knows nothing of what I do now." "The admirer?" said Fitzpiers, slyly. "I don't know if you would call him that," said Grace, with simplicity. "He admires a superficial, conditional creature, and this person is quite different. He has all the cardinal virtues. Perhaps, though, I don't know them precisely." "You unconsciously practice them, Miss Melberry, which is better. According to Schleiermacher, they are self-control, perseverance, wisdom, and love, and his is the best list that I know." I am afraid poor she was going to say that she feared Winterbourne, the giver of the purse years before, had not much perseverance, though he had all the other three, but she determined to go no further in this direction, and was silent. These half-revelations made a perceptible difference in Fitzpiers. His sense of personal superiority wasted away, and Grace assumed in his eyes the true aspect of a mistress in her lover's regard. "Miss Melberry," he said, suddenly, "I divine that this virtuous man you mention has been refused by you?" She could do no otherwise than admit it. "I do not inquire without good reason. God forbid that I should kneel in another's place at any shrine unfairly. But, my dear Miss Melberry, now that he is gone, may I draw near?" I can't say anything about that," she cried, quickly. "Because when a man has been refused, you feel pity for him, and like him more than you did before." This increasing complication added still more value to Grace in the surgeon's eyes. It rendered her adorable. "What cannot you say?" he pleaded, distractedly. I'd rather not. I think I must go home at once. Oh yes, said Fitzpiers. But as he did not move, she felt it awkward to walk straight away from him, and so they stood silently together. A diversion was created by the accident of two birds that had either been roosting above their heads or nesting there, tumbling one over the other into the hot ashes at their feet, apparently engrossed in a desperate quarrel that prevented the use of their wings. They speedily parted, however, and flew up, and were seen no more. That's the end of what is called love, said someone. The speaker was neither Grace nor Fitzpiers, but Marty South, who approached with her face turned up to the sky in her endeavor to trace the birds. Suddenly perceiving Grace, she exclaimed, Oh, Miss Melberry, I have been following the pigeons, and didn't see you. And here's Mr. Winterburn. She continued, shyly, as she looked towards Fitzpiers, who stood in the background. Marty, Grace interrupted. Want you to walk home with me, will you? Come along. And without lingering longer she took hold of Marty's arm, and led her away. They went between the spectral arms of the peeled trees as they lay, and onward among the growing trees, by a path where there were no oaks, and no barking, and no Fitzpiers, nothing but copsewood, between which the primroses could be discerned in pale bunches. Didn't know Mr. Winterburn was there, said Marty, breaking the silence when they had nearly reached Grace's door. Nor was he, said Grace. But, Miss Melberry, I saw him. No, said Grace. He was somebody else. Giles Winterburn is nothing to me. Gutenberg edition. End of chapter.